a doctor enters the hospital room where the family is gathered around the bed of a seriously ill patient. She has terminal cancer. She's in constant pain. The doctor consults with them all, including the patient, and they nod their heads affirmatively. The doctor administers drugs through an intravenous tube, and in an hour, the patient quietly expires. In another medical facility, a man with Alzheimer's is handed a glass of orange juice containing 40 ground-up barbiturates. He knowingly drinks the deadly potion and drifts into a coma and dies. In a third location, doctors in the ICU unit notify the family there is no chance of their loved one waking from the coma. They recommend removing life support systems, which the family agrees to, and their loved one passes within minutes. Those scenarios, all three, happen around the world every day. What is different about each of those scenarios? There is a difference. What is the reasoning behind it? There is reasoning. And most importantly, does the Bible say anything about that subject? This is our topic. End-of-life issues. It's not a pleasant subject. I think it's an important subject. I commend you for agreeing to discuss it and look at it in detail. I'm happy for that. I'm wondering how I got picked, unless somebody thinks Ralph's getting ready to deal with those. Actually, when the guys first proposed it to me, I misheard them, and I thought they were asking me to do a lesson on young people in China and Japan when they said, we want you to deal with youth in Asia. And I said, I can do that. There's a lot of statistics about that group. And then I found out that wasn't the topic at all, and I was too embarrassed to say no. I want to define some terms for you, first of all. I want you to understand the kinds of things we're going to be talking about tonight, because there are levels that I think are important for us to consider. I don't think we're talking about one subject that we can deal with in a broad brush term. First of all, there is suicide. And suicide, I think, would be defined as the willful, forcible ending of one's own life. When we talk about end-of-life issues, there are people who opt for this. I will take my own life. Whether that's done in some violent action, driving a car off a bridge, or the use of a firearm, or the overdosing with medicines that will take one's life. Suicide is one way people deal with end-of-life issues. They feel there's nothing left for me, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to deal with that in detail tonight. I will simply say this, and I'm prepared to defend it, though I don't want to take the time to do so in this lesson. I am prepared to defend this. The Bible always says suicide is wrong. The forcible, willful taking of one's own life is always depicted in the scriptures as a sinful action. And then there is physician-assisted suicide. It is called that. PSA, or PAS, is what it is normally referred to in journals. This is the action of a physician or a medical person to give to a patient the means by which that patient can end his own life. So physician-assisted suicide is different than suicide. It's taking a doctor's opportunities to give to the patient a way to take their life, usually not in a violent way. This would not be, and I'm not being, this would not be a doctor handing a patient a gun. This would be some kind of medicine that would allow that patient to forcibly take their own life. Third is euthanasia. Now, it's important when we get into this word that we understand it. It's broken down into two terms, eu, E-U, which means good, and thanos, which means death, a good death. You may have heard a similar term when you hear at a funeral somebody talking about giving a eulogy, eulogos, a good word about the person. So at a funeral, somebody would say good words about the person who died. Good death is what euthanasia is. It's called good death. So it has two forms. There is passive euthanasia, which is the actions of a caretaker to withhold necessities of life. That could be food or water or medicines in order to allow or help the patient to die. I can give you an example of it from the scriptures without going into a lot of detail, though it's one of my favorite stories in all the scriptures. The story is found in 2 Samuel 21. Not asking you to go there because you will get bogged down in a fascinating story. But when the Gibeonites come to David, because there's a famine in the land and David has been told there's a reason for the famine. It's because of what Saul did to the Gibeonites. And David goes to the Gibeonites and says, okay, what do you want? Let's try to make this right. And the Gibeonites say this, and it's very important. They say, it is not within our power to take a life. We can't do that. And so David responds, all right, then tell me what you want. I'll give it to you, whatever it is. And then they say, they bare the teeth, they unsheath the swords, and they say, we want 7 descendants of Saul, and we're going to hang them on a mountain at Gilboa, and they will die by exposure. Now, when you understand what's being said, what they're really offering is a form of passive euthanasia. We're not going to actively take their life, but we're going to deprive them of the things which would extend their life. Now, the difference in that story and our typical understanding of euthanasia is, in euthanasia, there is some sense of consent, either on the part of the person whose life is being taken or their family if they're not able to make that decision themselves. But passive euthanasia is simply depriving a patient of that which they would need to continue life so that they expire with the consent of the individuals. That's the difference. And Saul's sons didn't consent to die that way, but what a story. And then there is what we call active euthanasia. Active euthanasia is the action of a person to forcibly bring to an end the life of another with his or her own request or consent. So active euthanasia would be, if I may use another biblical example, in 1 Samuel chapter 31, when Saul is on Mount Gibeah and he is about to die because the Philistines are closing in on him, he says to his armor bearer, draw your sword and kill me. I don't want to fall into the hands of the Philistines. Now there's a man who is consenting to die, and he is asking another person to actively take his life. That would be, if it were carried out, active euthanasia. So, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to adopt physician-assisted suicide in 2002. There are 7 countries, most of them in Europe, which have legalized physician-assisted suicide. 4 of those countries have also legalized euthanasia. And in the United States, while active euthanasia, I forgot to give you that definition, is illegal in all 50 states. It's important for you to know, active euthanasia is illegal in all 50 states. Passive euthanasia is allowed in all 50 states. And physician-assisted suicide is legal in Vermont, New Mexico, Oregon, Washington, and you're probably thinking California, New York, Montana. So, let me go back over that one more time so we make sure we get our terms. We have first suicide. That's the active taking of one's own life. It is forcibly ending your personal life. The Bible is very clear about that. As I recall, there are six cases of suicide in the Bible, and there's not one of them that's a righteous person. They're all doing the wrong thing. And then there is physician-assisted suicide. And that is a doctor or a medical person giving to a patient the means by which that patient can take their own life. There is passive euthanasia. That is depriving a patient of the means by which life can continue, but not actively ending the life at a cessation point. And then there is active euthanasia, which is that. Active euthanasia is the forcible taking of the life of another with her consent or his consent. So, what is a good death? What is euthanasia? I want to define two different ways. I want to say, first of all, what our culture would say about that. Our culture would say it is the cessation of life to avoid excessive pain or suffering when it is believed that life will not improve with time. And the pain and suffering may be physical, emotional, or even financial. So let me make sure you understand. Our society says a good death is ceasing a life when there is so much pain that is not going to end, that a person can't have a pleasant, and when I say pleasant, I do not mean to make that trivial, but that you can't have quality of life, and that there is no foreseeable ending to that pain, that it is going to continue unabated. And that the pain and suffering that is under discussion, it may be physical, but it may also be emotional. In this country, euthanasia, passive euthanasia, may occur when somebody says and convinces a doctor or physician, I have no quality of life emotionally. I'm a wreck. I can't see anything good in my future. The pain is here. I'm not saying it's only mental, but I cannot exist in this form any longer. And it may be financial. I do not want to live and saddle my family with millions of dollars of debt. I will not do that. I'm not going to do that. I want my life to end. Now, that's how our culture would define a good death. That is what we are talking about to some degree tonight. To some degree. So let me introduce you to the Hemlock Society. What an interesting group. Founded in 1980. Derek Humphrey was a British journalist. In 1975, he gave his wife a fatal cup of coffee, which contained ground barbiturates and painkillers. She knowingly drank it to escape what she had, an incurable bone cancer, and she died within minutes. Humphrey migrated to the United States, and particularly to Los Angeles. And in 1980, he founded the Hemlock Society. Now, you may recognize the Hemlock Society's name. It was named for the cup of poisonous herbs that Socrates was sentenced to drink. But his was not a voluntary consumption. It's interesting that the Hemlock Society says you have the right to make a choice about whether you live or die. Socrates didn't have that choice. His drinking of hemlock was forced upon him as an alternative to physically taking his life with a sword. Perhaps the most celebrated member of the Hemlock Society was Dr. Kevorkian. And I'm not going into a lot of detail about Kevorkian. He was a bizarre character. Who probably drew some undue attention to the Hemlock Society, going even further than anybody in that society would have gone. He became the celebrity representative of that movement to allow people to end life on the basis, listen, that their body belongs to them. That's the whole idea. My body belongs to me. I can do with it what I want to do with it. I am the final stop in authority regarding my body. So in 2015, a British columnist named Katie Hopkins said, quote, "We just have far too many old people. It is ridiculous to be living in a country where we can put dogs to sleep, but not people." So a Dutch Right to Life, Right to Die organization picked up on that, and they're offering a mobile euthanasia service. Teams that travel around the country to deliver lethal drugs or injections to patients whose doctors have ethical objections to helping them die. Now, we don't have any of those here. So don't run when you hear those trucks going through your neighborhood playing that Calliope music. They're still selling ice cream cones. But if you were in the Netherlands, you might make a stop at the wrong truck. And let me just say, if you do that, one more white shirt will do you. The Netherlands have taken that stand to that extreme. Hey, we'll drive to you and make it easy for you to take your own life. Now, I want you to note that in some of the things that I've shared with you, the comparison that is made between humans and animals, the idea that, hey, we can take the life of dogs, but we can't take the life of humans on the same way. The only way one can arrive at that kind of equity is to say that human life and animal life is equivalent. And I don't want to get into an issue that some of you may have emotional ties to, but I want to tell you, we're not far off from that when we keep talking about our pets as if they're human. When we keep talking, oh, you won't believe my dog is incredible. The old commercial, my dog can say, I love you. And the dog goes, woo, woo, woo. Woo, woo, woo. And say, yeah, there you go, you heard it. When we have this idea that our pets have the same value as human life, we are treading into the area that ultimately may turn around from giving value to the dogs to devaluing humanity. That's where you may end up. Be very careful about that. I love pets. Well, almost all of them. I'm not a cat lover. I know. Go ahead. Cough up a hairball, all you that love cats. I do think they have a place and a value, but they are not equivalent to human life. if somebody takes the life of a dog, you do not take them to court for murder. It's not the same thing. And those of the Hemlock Society and other organizations like it have found a way to devalue human life by elevating the value of animal life. It reminds me, one of my favorite jokes is about a guy who's in a grocery store and he's overlooking at the cans of tuna. He's looking on the shelves trying to pick out tuna, and a lady comes by, and as he goes to grab a can, she goes, "You're not really buying that, are you?" And he says, "Well, yeah, I love tuna. Why wouldn't I buy it?" She says, "Well, you know, when they net tuna, sometimes they net porpoises and dolphins." And he said, "And your point is?" She said, "Well, dolphins and porpoises are intelligent." And he said, "Lady, they ain't netting the smart ones." I don't care how smart your animal is, they're not having the intelligence, quality of life, and value to God that humans have. And if we move to that point, well, we can kill dogs, but we can't kill humans. What's wrong? We've bought into, those people have bought into the idea that all life on earth has the same value. The Bible certainly does not teach that, even at the opening of creation. Man is created differently from the animals. It does not say of the animals he formed them from the dust or the ground, and that he breathed into him and he became a living soul. That's not said of dogs or cats or bears or boars or any other kind of animal. And it didn't say, and God said, "Let us make all life in our image." That's said of man, mankind. There is a difference between them. There is a difference because there is a physical body and there is a spiritual aspect to that physical body that humans have that animals don't. Lee Latour, who's director of the Hemlock Society, says, "Euthanasia is the abortion debate of the next century." It's the abortion debate all over again. Look, you think about the parallels. I don't know who's speaking on abortion. Don't want to take anything from their lesson on that. But the very idea of abortion is it's okay to take the life of a fetus because it doesn't have all the qualities of humanity. Not yet. It's not self-sustaining. It can't live independently. And once you grant that, you have already paved the way for a person who's in a hospital bed who isn't independent, who doesn't seem to have viability. And so we argue, well, then we can take that life too. They're very closely tied to each other, this idea of euthanasia and abortion. Now, let me say one thing that I think is important. Many of the decisions regarding the Hemlock Society and other organizations like it, those who are in favor of euthanasia, many of those decisions to end life are attempts to escape pain. Now, I know nobody wants incurable, unbearable pain for the rest of their life. But pain has a purpose. It was Philip Yancey and Dr. Brand who first brought that idea to my attention, but others have since then. M. Scott Peck, who wrote Denial of the Soul, who also wrote the book The Road Less Traveled, has some really important things to say about the value of pain. Pain has value. A lot of times we don't go to the doctor until we feel pain. What is the pain for? Is it just to make us miserable? Listen, is it just to take away the quality of life that we want to enjoy? Not at all. The purpose of pain is to identify to us something's wrong. So if I have pain in my jaw, I bite down, and there's pain there. my goal first ought to be, I need to find out why the pain is there. Not just get rid of the pain. Let's just kill the pain. Give me enough Novocaine and it'll go away. That's not the purpose of pain. Pain has a purpose, and it's to identify something's wrong. Something needs to be corrected. Like the guy said, Doc, my arm hurts when I do this. And the doc says, don't do that. Well, I think there's more to it than that. But Peck makes a very good point. He says, once the purpose or the reason for pain is determined, there really isn't much virtue in prolonging that pain. I mean, there's no virtue in having pain. I can deal with it. There are ways of dealing with pain. There are medicines that can help deal with pain, short of taking one's life. So Peck posits that euthanasia is not good death because it denies the soul that God placed in us. It denies there's a soul. That's where I've been leading to. So, what constitutes good death for a Christian? All right. I'm going to say this. I'm entering into this section with a great deal of trepidation. I think this is a very difficult subject. And I want to tell you, I haven't been where you are. There are some of you who are probably going to disagree with some of the conclusions I'm drawing as we go into the scriptures, because it's time now for us to move there as we talk about what constitutes that kind of death for the Christian. What is a good death? I realize I haven't been where all of you are, but you haven't been where I've been. And we've dealt with death both in our family, Paula's parents, my parents. We have dealt with deaths of people that we're very close to, dear friends. It doesn't make me an expert. And what I have to say is not rooted and formed and molded by my personal experiences. But I am telling you, I'm not speaking about this subject without attempting to apply the things that I think the Bible teaches about this in very practical ways in my own life. Now, I know when somebody gives a caveat like that, everybody's listening. And possibly defensively or critically. I think that a good death for a Christian is one that recognizes that death is natural and inevitable. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after death, the judgment. It is appointed. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27. It is appointed for us to die. So, fear of death and fighting inevitable death seems to me to be out of place for us. To be constantly fighting for life. It doesn't matter what year it is in our life. It doesn't matter what our circumstance is. It does not matter how near death we are. Fight for life. It seems to me that's not in keeping with what I understand the scriptures to teach. And a recognition that life after death is better than life before death. Life after death for the Christian is better than life before death. So if that is the case, it seems to me that that changes the way a lot of us have been looking at death and euthanasia. The Journal of the American Medical Association studied 9,000 chronically and seriously ill patients at 5 different U.S. medical centers over the period of 10 years. And let me tell you what they concluded. A large number of patients endured, quote, unnecessary, prolonged, and painful deaths due to unjustified heroic measures. Unjustified heroic measures. What would those include? Anything, the idea, anything to preserve life. Is that really where we ought to be as Christians? It does not matter what it costs. It does not matter how long it goes on. It does not matter how helpless the situation seems to be. You do everything in your power, medical authorities, to keep me or my loved one alive. Now, if the two premises we started with, right here behind me, are true, if those things are true, does that make sense? So ask this question. Are there circumstances in which life should be exchanged for a higher cause? Are there situations in which we would voluntarily give up life, put ourselves in a situation in which we will die for some higher cause? And let me give you 4 arguments that that is the case. And I begin with the obvious one. We would not be here if Jesus had not, what? Laid down his life for us. Now, if the ultimate goal of the Christian is, I want to preserve my physical life no matter what, I want to live as long as I can possibly live, even if it's not quality of life, I want to stay on this earth as long as I can, take every breath of air I can take at whatever cost it may incur to live physically. Take that to Jesus, who gave up his life for a greater cause. And I'm going to tell you something. You might be arguing, no, Jesus didn't do that. I mean, they took his life. He didn't do that. No, he did. He did. He said, I laid down my life and I take it up again. I lay it down. If he is responsible for his resurrection, he is responsible for his death. And God was actively involved in that. God so loved the world that he what? Allowed the world to take the life of his son? No, that he gave his son. But in addition to Jesus, one of the heroes we have in the Bible is the man Samson. And Samson, in Judges chapter 16, called on God to increase his strength so that he could pull the temple of Dagon down on the heads of all those in it and himself. And God did not say, I'll not participate in that. God gave him the power to do that. And do you know what the scriptures say? And Samson, in his death, killed more Philistines than those he had killed in his life. And we can interpret that by his death and by his life. And we call him a hero. A man who is doing something that will knowingly cause his own demise. What is he doing? I believe he's doing what this is asking behind me. He is exchanging life for a higher cause. I go to Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, and it's a passage we know well. It's a passage where Jesus is talking to one of the churches of Asia, and he says of them, you're about to undergo some serious trials. Some of you are going to be cast into prison, and there'll be tribulation. But be faithful to death, and I'll give you the crown of life. And what do we say about that? We say, if we understand the passage, it's not, that passage does not say, be faithful whether you're alive at 20 or you're alive at 110. That's not the point of that passage. Not that passage. In context, what that says is, you stay faithful even though it will mean your death. So when we start weighing that, is that a case where life and a greater cause are in opposition and I got to give up one? And most of us would say, well, don't ever renounce Christ so you can live if you have to. Acknowledge Jesus as Lord and die. There are circumstances and situations in which we who are Christians willingly, knowingly give up our physical lives in order to achieve some greater cause. In Romans chapter 14, verses 7 through 9, our last case, Jesus, Samson, Revelation, now Romans, and then Philippians. For not one of us lives for himself, and not one dies for himself. Dies for himself. There's a sense in which there, I have the choice to live, and sometimes I have the choice to die. For if we live, we live for the Lord, or if we die, we die for the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we're the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and of the living. And then when we go to Philippians chapter 1, we've got the Apostle Paul, and he's arguing this. Listen to what he says. Philippians chapter 1, I begin in verse 21. For to me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Now, I know there are many times in the Bible where death is a spiritual or symbolic thing. You know, that we die to ourselves. That's not what's being discussed here. That's not what's being discussed in Romans. In Romans, we're talking about physical death. For me, to live is Christ, to die is gain. How do you reckon Paul figures death is a gain? Not something to be avoided, not something to be denied, but something to be welcomed. Well, if I'm to live on in the flesh, it means fruitful labor for me. And I don't know which to choose. I'm hard-pressed having the desire to depart and be with Christ. My desire is to die. Now, I know he says, but I know that it's better for me to stay on, so I will. But his desire is to die. There is another case of somebody willing to exchange their life for a higher cause. So, given all that, is preserving physical life the ultimate good? Should we fight to live? All right, I'm going to pick up the pace so we can finish this. There is a value in the process of dying. Dylan Thomas, who was a Welsh poet, watched his father die. He wrote these lines that a lot of you know and think are so heroic. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. I'll tell you why Dylan Thomas said that, because there was no good beyond death. He was an unbeliever. So he told his father, fight to live. You rage against that. You don't give in, because that's all there is. Seneca, 2,000 years ago, said, throughout the whole of life. One must continue to learn how to live. And what will amaze you even more, dear friends, throughout life, one must continue to learn how to die. So Paul says, I die daily. Jesus said, take up your cross daily. It's the process of emptying yourself, of denying yourself, of refusing to grasp at this world. So I love this statement. Peck was asked a question often when he would lecture. Can you give a good example of God's grace? And here's what he said. Yes, we get to die. Now, I want you to think about that. Yes, God's grace is we get to die, because he said, I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little tired here. We sing songs all the time about longing for heaven, about this world is not my home. And I do wonder, brothers and sisters, if we don't deny that by the way we grasp and fight to hold on to life here. I had a young lady come to me recently. She said, I want you to pray for my grandmother. She's very ill. I said, what do you want me to pray? Pray that she'll get better. I said, how old is your grandmother? She said, she's 98. I said, how long do you want her here? Now, I'm not being funny. It's okay for you to chuckle because you were probably surprised I said that, but how long do you want her here? How long are we going to live in this world? How long are we going to fight to live in this world? We get in situations and doctors say, I think I can save them, but it's going to be a real long process. And we're going to have to put feeding tubes in and all kinds of things to keep them alive, to just keep the body physically alive. And I wonder, why do Christians do that? If we know. Now, if that girl had said to me, yeah, but my grandmother's not a Christian, and I want one more opportunity to tell her about Christ, oh, I'll pray about that. I'll pray about that. But just to prolong physical life? Is that really what we fight to do? Is that our way of raging against the dying light? Because we have this idolatry of longevity. We talk about people and say, oh, he was only 60 years old. She was only 70. She was only 86. You know, in 1900, life expectancy in America was 47. 47. If you lived to be 48, they celebrated how old you were. In 1954, it was 70. Today, it's 79. But we keep on wanting to live longer, longer, longer here, at whatever cost it may be, both to ourselves and to those who are caring for us. And we avoid the value of the process of dying if we want to physically cut that short or try to prolong life so we don't experience the process of dying. Dr. Catherine Kubler-Ross wrote on death and dying in 1969. She was the first to explore the stages of dying and what they mean to quality of living. So she said, here are the stages. Number one, denial. Doctor says, you're going to die. I say, no, I'm not. Must be the wrong test. You must have gotten somebody else's information. Doctors aren't always right. After denial comes anger. This isn't right. Why is God doing this to me? We fight against that. And then we reach a point of bargaining. God, if you'll just let me live longer, I'll be so faithful. I'll do so much for you. Let me live because I realize my life hasn't been what it ought to be. And then we move into a depression state. Okay, this is it. I'm going to die. But then what follows that is acceptance. This brilliant stage of acceptance. Okay, I'm going to die. I watched my mom do that in October of last year. Receive a diagnosis from the doctor, renal failure. If you don't undergo dialysis, you're not going to live. I'm not making an argument at all against any of you who have done dialysis or have people on it. But my mother said, that's not a quality of life I want. That's not where I want to be. She says, you're going to die if you don't do that. My mom said, okay. How long? 3 weeks to 3 months. 3 weeks later, my mother went to be with the Lord. I'm going to tell you something. I learned something from her. I learned value in that. This life is not what I want to fight to stay in. If I'm God's, I want to be with God. And you kind of reach that point of acceptance, and then things make sense. All right, I have one question. I'm going to answer it in just a couple of sentences. Somebody said, if you're going to talk about end-of-life issues, would you talk about cremation or burial? What's your understanding of the scriptures on that? Well, I want to say, first of all, some people have no choice about whether they'll be cremated or buried. There are those who die in fires. I was a firefighter for years. I knew there were people who died in house fires. They didn't have a choice. That's not against God's will. Burial at sea, where your body disintegrates and isn't buried or preserved. But I want to tell you just three things. Number one, we all decay. We will all be raised incorruptible. We will all be given a metamorphosized body. Metamorphosized. That's a great word. We're all going to get one. So I'm not really worried. I'm not worried. If I'm buried and my ashes are all gathered right there, that might be easier for the angels in heaven to put together and say, here's another one. Metamorphosize this one. But I am persuaded if they scattered my ashes over Hawaii, and somebody says, why Hawaii? I said, well, I never visited there before. If they do that and the angels go, oh, his ashes are everywhere, I'm persuaded they'll find them all. They'll put them all back together, and I will be raised incorruptible. I don't think the Bible says anything about the kinds of cremations that we do. There are some objections in the Bible to burning of bodies when it's done to gods, but nothing I know of about that as a practice in our culture. And I will tell you, cremation's a whole lot cheaper than burial. And you don't see either one of them after they happen. I'm not being flippant. I'm just telling you. I'm not arguing in favor of one or the other, but I don't know that one is heinous and the other acceptable to God. Hey, you've been very patient. And I know I've challenged you tonight. But I think there are circumstances in which children of God say, don't do anything else. I'm ready. I'm ready to go be with my Lord. Let's pray. Lord, may we have been true to your word tonight. May we have accurately described the glory of the creation you made in each one of us. And to honor that is our goal. But to fight to preserve life here on this earth is not what we want to do, because I don't believe, and I hope your people here don't believe, that's our ultimate goal. May we live our lives in such a way that after death, life is better in every way than it was here. In the name of the resurrected one, hear our prayer. Amen.